Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, children caught up in conflict. Pope Benedict calls for moves in defence of children who are caught up in armed conflicts around the world and those who are victims of violence, hunger and abuse. Kill or be killed. We look more closely at the issue of child soldiers and listen to the shocking testimony from a girl who was kidnapped by rebels in Uganda and from a boy seized by rebels in Sudan. Faith and the cosmos. The president of the Vatican Observatory Foundation tells us more about the relationship between the two. And John the Forerunner. As the Church marks today's feast day of St. John the Baptist, we take a closer look at this key biblical figure. Benedict called for moves to defend children from becoming the victims of violence and armed conflicts around the world. His appeal came as he greeted a delegation who were attending a symposium in Rome discussing the issue of children caught up in armed conflict. The delegation met the Pope at the end of his Wednesday audience. My colleague Emma McCarthy tells us more.
On Wednesday, Pope Benedict said he always remembers in prayer the children who are victims of violence and weapons, and all the children of the world, in particular, those who are exposed to fear, abandonment, hunger, abuse, illness, and death. The Pope was speaking at the end of his Wednesday audience just before meeting with a delegation led by the UN Undersecretary and Special Representative for Children in Situations of Armed Conflict. In comments in Italian, he also touched upon the theme of helping the victims of war in remembering this year's celebration of the 150th anniversary of the founding of the Red Cross. Over the years, he said, the values of universality, neutrality, independence in service have attracted the membership of millions of volunteers all over the world, forming an important bastion of humanity and solidarity in many contexts of war and conflict, as well as in many emergencies. In expressing the hope that the human person, in all his or her dignity and entirety, is always at the heart of the Red Cross humanitarian aid, I especially encourage young people to engage in this worthy institution.
Approfitto di questa circostanza per chiedere il rilascio.
Pope Benedict also took the advantage on this occasion of appealing for the release of all kidnapped persons in conflict zones, and once again he asked for the release of Eugene Wagen, a Red Cross operator who was kidnapped months ago in the Philippines.
Dear brothers and sisters.
But the main body of his Wednesday catechesis this week was given over to ringing out the Pauline year and ringing in the year for the priest.
The Pauline year now ending, and the current year for priests invite us to consider how the Apostle Paul and the humble Curia of Ars both identified themselves completely with their ministry, striving to live in constant communion with Christ.
Pope Benedict augured that this year for priests would help all priests grow towards the spiritual perfection which is essential to the effectiveness of their ministry and enable the faithful to appreciate more fully the great gift of grace which is the priesthood, for priests themselves, for the Church, and for our world. I'm Emma McCarthy.
Hunger and violence, trouble.
The main thing is to be forced to kill someone and the breaking of my innocence. And to be given a gun. You've never handled a gun before and you're forced to shoot. There's something they call these days kill or be killed. The survival techniques that I had to go through to kill someone. And I still feel guilty about that and I have to deal with it every day.
The grim reality of life as a child soldier, told there by Grace Akalo, who was kidnapped at the age of 15 from her school dormitory one night by the notorious LRA rebels in Uganda. Like the other captives, she was forced to fight and forced under pain of death to kill other girls who tried to escape and was repeatedly raped by the rebel commanders. After 7 horrific months as a slave of the rebels, Akolo managed to escape and made her way home. Now aged 28, she is studying in Boston and is co-author of a best-selling book about her appalling experience as a child soldier. She is also a leading member of a network of former child soldiers called NYPAW that seeks to give a voice to young people who have been the victims of conflict in this way.
I was among the victims of the rebellion at the age of 8 to 14. In the front line, we fight with the enemy. At the orders I was, I got no choice but to fight.
Akolo was one of the key participants at that symposium on children and armed conflict that was organised in Rome this week by the Italian government, UNICEF and NGOs. She was also part of the delegation that met briefly with Pope Benedict during his audience. But to find out more details of what it actually means to be a child soldier, I spoke to Akolo earlier, during a pause in the proceedings of the symposium. I began by asking her to describe her feelings when she was seized by the rebels as she and her classmates lay sleeping in their school dormitory in northern Uganda.
I was scared, but scared is just a word to say, but it was beyond fear because I thought I was going to die. When the rebels were breaking the windows and screaming at us and pointing the AK-47 inside the dome and pointing the grenades inside, I thought I was going to die. I thought I was going to be blown up. All my friends were screaming. They were running from one direction to another, urinating all over the place. It was something that is hard to describe at that time.
How did your religious faith help you to endure and survive this ordeal?
Well, before I went to St. Mary's College at Boke, my mother is a Christian. She's a Catholic, but my father is an Anglican Protestant. And I used to follow her to church. I used to follow her, and she would encourage me and say, you know, the fact of the life is we don't have life in our hands. We can die any time. So you have to have faith. But usually as a child, you're like, oh, whatever, who cares? But that day, I remembered my mother's voice was ringing in my ears, like, you have to have faith. This life is a short life. And I started praying. I was like, God, help me, even if I've been a very big sinner, help me. And all the way that I was taken into the bush, I kept praying, and my friends too kept praying. So it was good that we had faith. It was good that I had faith. Otherwise, I would have lost completely.
What was your worst moment, or the worst thing you were asked to do?
Several things. Everything was a worst moment. I was forced to kill, and that's worst enough, because in my life I'd never even beaten someone. I was always scared of touching someone to fight.
Was that in the battle, or was it
just after, immediately after abduction? We were forced to kill, beat the girl to death. After 2 weeks in captivity, this girl tried to escape, and they called all of us, all the newly abducted children, to beat this girl to death. It was bad. She was 12 years old. And another thing is forcing you to have sex with someone who's older than your father. It takes away the sense of worth that you have in your life.
What are your most lasting wounds then after this dreadful experience?
I learned to forgive, actually, because I believe that forgiveness makes you go forward, makes you do more things, because if you dwell on what happens to you, then it breaks or it blocks the dreams that you have, the future that you hope to see. So right now, I am on the process of forgiving the people who did all this to me. But at the same time, I feel pain because these horrible things are still going on. This pain is still inflicted on children. So whenever I hear news of abduction, whenever I hear news of killing, it's enough to make me go mad, go feel pain again, like it's happening right there in front of me.
I cry, I feel bad, I feel sad, I feel that with the hand of the world.
Another former child soldier who attended the symposium was Kon Kele, who was seized by SPLA rebels in southern Sudan at the tender age of around 6 or 7. He is also a member of the NYPAW network and is currently studying in the Netherlands. Kelly told me about his experience as a child soldier.
I think I was probably 6 or 7 years old when I was involved in armed conflict.
Do you remember that day?
I do very good, because it was a moment that it was, when it was starting, it was for me very exciting, because the way it happened in some other countries is forced with a gunpoint, but in Sudan, in southern Sudan, we were collected together as children and sent to a center. So the moment that we, all of us, moved, all boys, was wonderful.
Thought it was a great adventure.
Yes, but then come the moment after 2 hours walking, and now we want to go back home, but there was no way back. And that was tragic.
What was your worst moment as a child soldier?
My worst moment was after 2 weeks that we were in the camp. One of the child died.
Why? How?
He died of hunger and sickness, name it. And then I wore shoes as one of the children who are going to bury that child. And I never see a dead person. But by then, I have to go and dig the ground, bury that child. And it kept reminding me it was not a moment to be there. I wish I were that child in place of being the digging person.
What was the worst thing you were made to do while you were a child soldier?
I can say luckily enough, I was not forced to kill somebody. But there were these moments that I stand in a position to betray my colleagues who might have did something wrong. And I'm obliged to say he did it. And I know what that child will go through. So these are the moments that you don't want to make, because you know that guy next time is the one who is going to help you, and now you betray him.
Hunger and violence, trouble and balance, child soldier.
An estimated 250,000 children worldwide have been unlawfully recruited to take part in armed conflicts. And some studies I read suggest the problem could be growing. But is this true? And if so, why? A question I put to Radhika Komaraswamy, the UN Secretary General's Special Representative for Children and Armed Conflicts, and one of the main organisers of the symposium in Rome.
Okay, I read that studies suggest that the number of children worldwide forcibly recruited to fight in armed conflicts is on the increase. If that's true, why?
Actually, it's on the decrease. That's good news. There were supposedly 300,000, and now we're estimating it at 250,000, but these are all guesstimates. And the reason for the decrease is the end of the wars in Sierra Leone and Liberia, which had very large numbers of child soldiers. But still, it's a major problem. It's there in practically all the conflicts around the world, especially internal conflicts.
You come from Sri Lanka, where, of course, as you just said, there are a lot of children who fought, particularly on the side of the Tamil Tigers. Is there an awareness that it's morally wrong to force children to fight in wars?
Well, if there wasn't in the beginning, there was definitely toward the end, because of the activism of groups like UNICEF and others to make it very clear that this is a war crime. And though there was during the peace period and immediately after the peace period, the figures dropped. In the last stages of the war, they were very much on the increase by the LTTE. And also the paramilitary organization in the East also recruited children.
If you could sum up in a few sentences, what's the message you're trying to send through this symposium?
Well, what we're trying to send a message is public awareness on this issue, to push political leaders. There are two kinds of things we want from political actors. One is the political will to implement international frameworks, and the second is the political will to fund programs by our partners that help to reintegrate children back into their communities. We find that we need to implement the Paris principles fully, and we need the support of the international community to do so.
What are some of the worst experiences the child soldiers have had to endure? I mean, I'm sure you've come across stories or anecdotes told to you. If you could maybe just share with us one of them.
Well, on child soldiers, you heard Grace's story. Well, I had a story of Moy, for example, whom I met, who was playing with his friend in his home when the LRA came and abducted him, took him away, and then his friend couldn't make it to the campsite, so he tripped and fell, so they killed the friend right in front of him. He became a part of this group. He was forced to raid his own villages and attack his own families, and then he escaped finally and joined UNICEF. And when he met me, he said, "Well, what can I do, madam? The only thing I can do is fight now."
I was speaking to Radhika Komaraswamy, the UN Secretary General's Special Representative for Children and Armed Conflict. And earlier you heard the testimony of Grace Akolo and Kon Kele, both former child soldiers. Faith and the Cosmos was the title of a seminar held in the Vatican today as part of the ongoing initiatives to celebrate the International Year of Astronomy. Organised jointly by the Vatican Observatory and the Pontifical Council for Culture, the speakers at the seminar discussed topics covering biblical cosmology and the vastness of the cosmos. The seminar was held in conjunction with a week-long conference on astronomy, organised by the Vatican Observatory in honour of the International Year of Astronomy. Among the speakers at the seminar was Father George Coyne, Director Emeritus of the Vatican Observatory, who delivered an address entitled "Life in the Universe, So Marvellous, So Many Questions." He shared with me some of his insights into this fascinating topic.
I would say my scientific knowledge of the cosmos helps to enrich my faith. And the reason I say that is because I don't think that my scientific knowledge is any different from the scientific knowledge of one who does not have the faith. The faith does not help us to do our science any better, because science is a very strict methodology. And a scientist follows that same methodology, whether he's a believer or a non-believer. However, the other way around is the most important way to look at things, I think. I'm both a scientist and I am a religious believer, obviously. When I do my science, I come to certain scientific conclusions, and that's it. I come to a knowledge that the universe is expanding and evolving in its evolution. Life came to be. We came to be. I can ask all kinds of scientific questions as to how we came to be, and I get at least tentative scientific answers. But then when I get them, that's very limited knowledge. And any scientist who really knows science will admit that our scientific knowledge is very limited. I'm not just a walking brain, a walking scientist, let's say. I have emotional experiences. I like music. I like art. I like some people better than others and all of this kind of thing. In addition to those wide human experiences, one is that I truly believe that God created the universe that I am investigating as a scientist. So why don't I, as a religious believer, say what kind of God would make a universe as I know the universe from science? Is there any, does it help me to understand a God who I believe created the universe? And indeed, it does. It certainly very much enriches my faith, because I see a universe that God is marvelous in creating this universe. He didn't create a washing machine.
You talked about our marvelous universe, and I know that your intervention at this symposium was entitled "Life in the Universe, So Marvelous, So Many Questions." When you first began your studies as an astronomer, what were for you the most pressing of these many questions about our marvelous universe?
Well, the direct questions I had in my, many, many years ago when I first started doing research was simply to answer certain questions about double stars, binary stars that are going around one another. So that's just a little piece of the universe. But as my research went on and I was able to build up a bigger picture of the universe as a whole, it does become marvelous. I mean, most scientists before on this vast universe, even though most of us are studying just a part of it, marvel at the immensity of the universe, at the beauty of the universe, at the complexity of the universe, and at the fact that we are part of the universe we're investigating. So when I come to reflect to the return upon God, God did not make a universe predetermined, so to speak. He made a universe that has a creativity and a dynamism of its own through the evolutionary process. And of course, we share very much in that. As best we know, we're probably the most creative things in the universe, we human beings, as far as we know scientifically. So what I'm saying is it enriches my knowledge of God the Creator as one who put a universe out there, so to speak, and with tender, loving care is helping it to evolve. But this God is not predetermining everything that will happen. He has shared with the universe his or her own creativity. That's the brief message I have.
It seems we can't talk about faith and astronomy without people bringing up questions about past conflicts or tensions between religious faith and science, e.g. the Church's right. Inquisition of Galileo. Do you believe there is always likely to be a certain amount of tension between the two?
Oh, I believe there is. By the very nature of the two, there will always be a certain amount of tension. But that's a creative tension. That's a good tension, provided that both the culture of science and the culture of religious faith have respect for these diverse cultures and many other aspects of human culture, that there is a respectful dialogue, not a kind of a domineering, a dictating, autocratic kind of attitude, but an open dialogue. And certainly now, in our times, this is very true, from both, so to speak, sides of the fence. I mean, science in general depends on the particular scientist, of course, but there are many more scientists, I would say, who are sincerely interested in the dialogue. And certainly the Catholic Church has opened itself very much, certainly from the beginning of the papacy of John Paul II and into the current papacy, opened itself to a dialogue with science. Because the troubles that have occurred when they're studied with a certain degree of historical accuracy, it always comes, the troubles arose through ignorance on one side or the other, and most frequently on both. And if we can dialogue so that we kind of remove that ignorance, I think the tension itself will always be there, but it will be a creative tension. It will help all of us grow more in our knowledge of the universe and our respect for one another, and if we're believers, in our search to deepen our faith.
I was talking to Father George Coyne, priest and astronomer, and president of the Vatican Observatory Foundation and director emeritus of the Vatican Observatory. June the 24th marks the feast of the birth of St. John the Baptist, a key biblical figure whose mission was to announce the coming of Jesus the Messiah. The Gospel tells how John preached in the Jordan Valley and urged his hearers to repent and be baptized, and in due course he came to baptize Jesus. John was executed by King Herod somewhere between AD 26 and 31 after publicly criticizing his second wife Herodias. These are the bare bones of John the Baptist's life. But let's try to flesh out the details of this saint and find out more about his preaching and why he has always been so revered. Monsignor Paul Tai is the secretary at the Pontifical Council for Social Communications.
John the Baptist, I suppose, in many ways is the last of the great figures of the Old Testament. And yet he's there right at the beginning of the New Testament. So he's this kind of crucial figure in terms of the transition from the Old Testament to the New Testament. One of the great German theologians, Bornkamm, described him as a sentinel standing at the frontier between two aeons. And the other thing about him, I think, as a figure is he's an extraordinarily attractive figure. There's something very strange. He's a figure that has appealed to artists, has appealed to musicians, as a figure who captures the imagination. But in capturing the imagination of people, even in his own time, probably capturing their imagination with the strangeness of dress, with the exaggerated nature of his lifestyle. He always sought not that attention for himself, but to direct them and lead them towards Christ. So he's the last of the great figures, the great Old Testament prophets, pointing, leading us towards the Messiah.
And you said, you know, his interesting lifestyle. I mean, he was very austere, and this austere, solitary life in the desert. I mean, he's very much could be seen as a monk.
In many ways, would be seen as a kind of a precursor of a monk, the man who went out to the desert. The desert for the Jewish people would have been that area where there was barren. It was the place where there was no life. It's the place where, if you went, you had to depend completely and totally on God. And that, in a sense, is John the Baptist. He's the one who entrusts himself completely to his Lord. And that, again, is part of that type of figure will always appeal, I think, to people. The person who reminds them of something else. Not that all of us are going to make these radical choices, abandon our everyday lives, go off and do something extraordinary, heroic or different. But the fact that there are some who do that helps us to kind of maybe keep a perspective on our own existence and stop absolutizing the everyday, important and all as it is.
He's also been described as an anti-establishment figure. I mean, he hated hypocrisy, he warned of divine punishment for sinners, and he also, of course, didn't flinch at speaking out against people in high places, and that outspokenness cost him his life, didn't it?
Yeah, again, it's the figure of the prophet, the very strong prophet who fears nothing, who speaks the truth as he sees it and has no difficulty in facing the consequences of that. I think an image that I've been reading about and I think is nice is that John the Baptist was really one of the great figures of judgment. He pronounced judgment. In particular, he called people to repentance, to recognition of their own failings and weaknesses, whereas Christ himself is more the figure of salvation. John the Baptist tells us where it's all gone dreadfully wrong, why we've all made mistakes, why it's all collapsing about us. Jesus then offers us the way out of that. He offers us the salvation, the possibility of being saved in the midst of that. So therefore, people would be very keen on trying to see John the Baptist not simply as a figure in himself, but always must be understood in relationship to Jesus. So without the message of Jesus, the salvation, the hope, the possibility of redemption, the preaching, the teaching of John the Baptist could be something perceived as very negative. In fact, the great German theologian Bonhoeffer used to talk about there was a choice in life. We could either despair or we could turn to Christ. And maybe if we'd been left alone with the message of John the Baptist, it might have been more towards a kind of a sense of being judged and being without hope. But his message was always to bring people to a realization of their need for Christ and for the salvation that Christ would offer.
And we see from the Bible, don't we, that Jesus thought very highly of John.
Jesus, very highly of John. And Jesus, in many ways, positioned his ministry as a response to some of the work of John. Jesus himself also picked up the message of repentance, repent and believe the good news. And this sense, I think people would say that John is a figure of continuing relevance. Even though he may be seen as an Old Testament figure in some ways theologically, many people would interpret him as a great figure, particularly for those who minister in the name of the church and for the church itself in its own ministry, that we must call people to a recognition of where there is failing, where there is weakness, where there is a lack of hope and trust in people's lives, but not just hold them there, not just leave them there without a response, but to bring them to the fullness of Jesus. Again, often people would say is that the minister, the priest, the preacher, in a sense, relies on his or her own personality to bring somebody, to attract somebody. But again, that's not just to hold them. It's not for ourselves. It's to lead them to Christ.
How ancient is his cult, as far as we know?
It's one of the very oldest. I was reading again. It seems that in Constantinople, at the earliest Christian times, there was something like 15 different churches dedicated to John the Baptist.
I was talking to Monsignor Paul Tai, secretary at the Pontifical Council for Social Communications.
Well, that's all from Vatican Radio's English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. Laudato Jesus Christus.